Thank you very much, Dr. Bergsma, for that introduction. It's wonderful to be with you here. I would just like to say that over the years, I've found out that it's good for me to start with a slight disclaimer, saying that what you're about to hear is my opinions, that it's not my colleagues, not my university. My mother disagrees with me. Intelligent design is a, shall we say, controversial subject. So this is just me talking. And the title is something different from what's in the program. I think the program had something mild like the argument for intelligent design from biology. This is a little edgier, and it'll I thought it might be fun to do that. But I'm actually going to talk about both of those topics, about the argument for design, and then switch over and tell you why I think design is not at all compatible with Darwinism. Okay, so let me start here. In this paper, I will argue two points. First, that some biological systems at the molecular level strongly appear to be the result of deliberate intelligent design. And second, that Darwin's theory of evolution by random mutation and natural selection, the dominant view in the biological community, is utterly incompatible with the theory of purposeful intelligent design. So, first, the modern argument for intelligent design in biology. I am well aware that arguments for design in biology have been made before, most notably by William Paley in the 19th century. So I think it's important right at the beginning to clearly distinguish modern arguments for design from earlier versions. The most important difference is that my argument is limited to design itself. I strongly emphasize that it is not an argument for the existence of a benevolent God, as Paley's was. I hasten to add that I myself do believe in a benevolent God, and I recognize that philosophy and theology may be able to extend the argument. But a scientific argument for design in biology does not reach that far. Thus, while I argue for design, the question of the identity of the designer is left open. Possible candidates for the role of designer include the God of Christianity, an angel, fallen or not, Plato's demiurge, some mystical New Age force, space aliens from Alpha Centauri, time travelers, or some utterly unknown intelligent being. Of course, some of these possibilities may seem more plausible than others based on information from fields other than science. Nonetheless, as regards the identity of the designer, modern ID theory happily echoes Isaac Newton's phrase, hypothesis non fingo. The fact that modern intelligent design theory is a minimalist argument for design itself, not an argument for the existence of God, relieves it of much of the baggage that weighed down Paley's argument. First of all, it is immune to the argument from evil. It matters not a whit to the scientific case whether the designer is good or bad, interested in us or disinterested. It only matters whether an explanation of design appears to be consistent with the biological examples I point to. Second, questions about whether the designer is omnipotent or even especially competent do not arise in my case as they did in Paley's. Perhaps the designer isn't omnipotent or especially competent. More plausibly, perhaps the designer was not interested in every detail of biology, as Paley thought, so that while some features were indeed designed, others were left to the vagaries of nature. Thus, the modern argument for design need only show that intelligent agency appears to be a good explanation for some biological features. Thus, compared to William Paley's argument, modern intelligent design theory is very restricted in scope. However, what it lacks in scope, it makes up for in resilience. Paley conjoined a number of separable ideas in his argument: design, omnipotence, benevolence, and so on, which made his overall position quite brittle. For example, arguments against the perceived benevolence of the design became arguments against the very existence of design. Thus, one got the seeming non sequitur, stating that because biological feature A appears malevolent, therefore all biological features arose by natural selection or some other unintelligent process. With the much more modest claims of modern ID theory, such a move is not possible. Attention is kept focused on the basic question of whether unintelligent processes could produce the complex structures of biology or whether intelligence was indeed required. Another important point to emphasize right at the beginning is that mine is indeed a scientific argument, not a philosophical or theological argument. Let me explain what I mean by that without getting entangled in trying to define those elusive terms. By calling the argument scientific, I mean first that it does not rest on any tenet of any particular creed, nor is it a deductive argument from first principles. Rather, it depends critically on physical evidence found in nature. Second, because it depends on physical evidence, it can potentially be falsified by other physical evidence. Thus, it is tentative, only claiming that it currently seems to be the best explanation given the information we have available to us right now. I do acknowledge that the scientific argument for design may have theological implications, but that does not change its status as a scientific idea. I would like to draw a parallel between the modern argument for design in biology and the Big Bang theory in physics. The Big Bang theory strikes many people as having theological implications, as shown by those who do not welcome those implications. For example, in 1999, John Maddox, the editor of Nature, the world's leading science journal, published a very peculiar editorial entitled "Down with the Big Bang," in which he wrote, "Apart from being philosophically unacceptable, the Big Bang is an oversimple view of how the universe began, and it is unlikely to survive the decade ahead. Creationists seeking support for their opinions have ample justification in the Big Bang." And by creationist, he means anybody who believes that something beyond nature has affected nature. Nonetheless, despite its theological implications, the Big Bang theory is a completely scientific one, which justifies itself by physical data, not by appeals to holy books. I think a theory of intelligent design in biology fits in the same category. While it may have theological implications, it justifies itself by physical data. Furthermore, just as the Big Bang theory could be overturned tomorrow by new evidence, so could intelligent design theory. Both are tentative. With these preliminary remarks in mind, I now turn to considering the scientific case for intelligent design in biology. In 1859, Charles Darwin published his great work on the Origin of Species, in which he proposed to explain how the great variety and complexity of the natural world might have been produced solely by the action of undirected physical processes. His proposed mechanism was, of course, natural selection working on random variation. In a nutshell, Darwin reasoned that the members of a species whose chance variation gave them an edge in the struggle to survive would tend to survive and reproduce. If the variation could be inherited, then over time, the characteristics of the species would change. And over great periods of time, perhaps great changes could occur. It was a very elegant idea. Nonetheless, Darwin knew his proposed mechanism could not explain everything. And in The Origin, he gave us a criterion by which to judge his theory. He wrote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down," adding, however, that he could find out no such case. Darwin, of course, was justifiably interested in protecting his fledgling theory from easy dismissal, and so he threw the burden of proof on opponents to prove a negative, to demonstrate that something could not possibly have happened, which is essentially impossible to do in science. Nonetheless, let's ask, what might at least potentially meet Darwin's criterion? What sort of organ or system seems quite unlikely to be formed by numerous successive slight modifications? A good place to start is with one that is what I call irreducibly complex. In Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge of Evolution, I defined an irreducibly complex system as a single system which is composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, and where the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. A good illustration of an irreducibly complex system from our everyday world is a simple mechanical mousetrap. A common mousetrap has several parts, including a wooden platform, a spring with extended ends, a hammer, holding bar, and catch. Now, if the mousetrap is missing the spring, or the hammer, or the platform, it doesn't catch mice half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to. It simply doesn't catch mice at all. Therefore, it is irreducibly complex. It turns out that irreducibly complex systems are headaches for Darwin's theory, because they are resistant to being produced in the gradual, step-by-step manner that Darwin envisioned. As biology has progressed with dazzling speed in the past 60 years, we have discovered that the cell, the very foundation of life, is run by machines. Machines made out of molecules, which, like a mousetrap, are irreducibly complex. Time permits me to mention only one example here, which will be familiar to anyone who follows this topic, the bacterial flagellum. The flagellum is quite literally an outboard motor that some bacteria use to swim. It is a rotary device, which, like a motorboat, turns a propeller to push against liquid, moving the bacterium forward in the process. It consists of a number of parts, including a long tail that acts as a propeller, the hook region, which attaches the propeller to the drive shaft, the motor, which uses a flow of acid from the outside of the bacterium to the inside to power the turning, a stator, which keeps the structure stationary in the plane of the membrane while the propeller turns, and bushing material to allow the drive shaft to poke up through the bacterial membrane. In the absence of the hook, or the motor, or the propeller, or the drive shaft, or most of the 30 different types of proteins that genetic studies have shown to be necessary for the activity or construction of the flagellum, one doesn't get a flagellum that spins half as fast as it used to, or a quarter as fast. Either the flagellum doesn't work, or it doesn't even get constructed in the cell. Like a mousetrap, the flagellum is irreducibly complex. And again, like the mousetrap, its evolutionary development by numerous successive slight modifications is quite difficult to envision. In fact, if one examines the scientific literature, one quickly sees that no one has ever proposed a serious, detailed model for how the flagellum might have arisen in a Darwinian manner, let alone conducted experiments to test such a model. Thus, in a flagellum, we seem to have a serious candidate to meet Darwin's criterion. We have a system which seems very unlikely to have been produced by numerous successive slight modifications. Is there an alternative explanation for the origin of the flagellum? I think there is, and it's really pretty easy to see. The flagellum was designed, purposely designed by an intelligent agent. How do we perceive design? Design is positively apprehended in the purposeful arrangement of parts. Looked at this way, irreducibly complex systems, such as mouse traps and flagella, serve both as negative arguments against gradualistic explanations like Darwin's and as positive arguments for intelligent design. The negative argument is that such interactive systems resist explanation by the tiny steps that a Darwinian path would be expected to take. The positive argument is that their parts appear arranged to serve a purpose, which is exactly how we detect design. Let me reinforce the positive argument here with the remarks of someone else who is very concerned about the appearance of intelligent design in life. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Thus spake Richard Dawkins on the first page of the first chapter of his classic defense of Darwinism, The Blind Watchmaker. Let me repeat. Dawkins says that's the very definition of biology, the study of things that appear designed. In his typically clear prose, Dawkins concisely stated the positive case for design in biology, which, of course, he was intent on demolishing. Yet, what is it about living things that make them appear to have been designed, even to such a stalwart Darwinist as himself? Design isn't some default conclusion we draw when we can't think of anything else. Nor is it based on, say, our warm, fuzzy feelings at seeing a pretty sunset. Rather, says Dawkins, it's what we conclude when we get in touch with our inner engineer. We may say that a living body or organ is well designed if it has attributes that an intelligent and knowledgeable engineer might have built into it in order to achieve some sensible purpose, such as flying, swimming, seeing. It is not necessary to suppose that the design of a body or organ is the best that an engineer could conceive of. But any engineer can recognize an object that has been designed, even poorly designed, for a purpose. And he can usually work out what that purpose is just by looking at the structure of the object. In other words, we conclude design from the physical evidence when we see a number of elements coming together to accomplish an identifiable function, the purposeful arrangement of parts. Dawkins doesn't just grudgingly acknowledge some faint impression of design in life. He insists that the appearance of design, which he ascribes to natural selection, is overpowering. The positive case for design in life is exactly as Dawkins sees. It is based on the physical arrangement of parts, where the parts work together to fulfill a function. And it is overwhelming. And because the positive case for design is indeed so overwhelming, it requires comparatively less explication. On the other hand, more attention is required to make it crystal clear why random mutation and natural selection, especially at the molecular level, are not the powerful explanations of life that they are so often touted to be, pace Richard Dawkins, which is why the bulk of my book, Darwin's Black Box, is devoted to that. By the end of the book, we see that there is little relevant evidence to show how Darwinian processes might account for the elegant complexity of molecular machinery, that there is a formidable structural obstacle, irreducible complexity, to thinking that such a mechanism can do the job, and that the appearance of design is even more overwhelming at the molecular level than at higher levels of biology. Here, then, is the argument for design in a nutshell. Number one, we infer design whenever parts appear arranged to accomplish a function. Two, the strength of the inference is quantitative and depends on the evidence. The more parts and the more intricate and sophisticated the function, the stronger is our conclusion of design. With enough evidence, our confidence in design can approach certitude. If, while crossing a heath, we stumbled across a watch, no one would doubt, as Paley rightly said, that the watch was designed. We would be as certain about that as about anything in nature. Number three, aspects of life overpower us with the appearance of design. Four, since we have no other convincing explanation for that strong appearance of design, Darwinian pretensions notwithstanding, then we are rationally justified in concluding that parts of life were indeed purposely designed by an intelligent agent. A crucial, often overlooked point is that the overwhelming appearance of design strongly affects the burden of proof. In the presence of manifest design, the onus of proof is on the one who denies the plain evidence of his eyes. For example, a person who conjectured that the statues on Easter Island or the images on Mount Rushmore were actually the result of unintelligent forces would bear the substantial burden of proof that claim demanded. In those examples, the positive evidence for design would be there for all to see in the purposeful arrangement of parts to produce the images. Any putative evidence for the claim that the images were actually the result of unintelligent processes, perhaps erosion shaped by some vague hypothesized chaotic forces, would have to clearly show that the postulated unintelligent process could indeed do the job. In the absence of such a clear demonstration, any person would be rationally justified to prefer the design explanation. I think these factors account to a large degree for why, much to the consternation of Darwinian biologists, the bulk of the public rejects unintelligent processes as sufficient explanations for life. People perceive the strong appearance of design in life, are unimpressed with Darwinian arguments and examples, and will reach their own conclusions, thank you very much. Without strong, convincing evidence to show that Darwin can do the trick, the public is quite rational to embrace design. Now I'm going to turn to my argument that Darwinism is utterly incompatible with intelligent design. In July 2005, in the New York Times, Cardinal Christoph Schoenborn wrote, "Evolution in the sense of common ancestry might be true, but evolution in the neo-Darwinian sense, an unguided, unplanned process of random variation and natural selection is not. Any system of thought that denies or seeks to explain away the overwhelming evidence for design in biology is ideology, not science. I think these two sentences of the Cardinals capture the crux of the discussion, and I think Cardinal Schoenborn is exactly correct here. Now let me explain why. Excuse me, it was a real good dinner. Discussion of evolution, Darwinism, and design becomes hopelessly confused if one is not exceedingly careful to define the terms and use them consistently. The definition of evolution that I will use is simply descent with modification, nothing more. That is, I use the word evolution to mean that organisms are related to each other by a process of physical descent, but the mechanism driving the origin and major changes in life is left unspecified. Now, by itself, such a restricted notion of evolution, while interesting, has very little limited importance to philosophy and theology. As Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger wrote in 1986 in his short book, In the Beginning, A Catholic Understanding of the Story of Creation and the Fall, it is the affair of the natural sciences to explain how the tree of life in particular continues to grow and how new branches shoot out from it. This is not a matter for faith. Most difficulties on the topic arise only when we begin to discuss the mechanism of evolution. That is, what exactly caused the major changes of life? What caused life to evolve into intricate and complex forms? On this point, the future Pope Benedict XVI was clear. He wrote, "Let us go directly to the question of evolution and its mechanisms. Microbiology and biochemistry have brought revolutionary insights here. They have brought us to the awareness that an organism and a machine have many points in common. Their functioning presupposes a precisely thought through and therefore reasonable design." And he continued, "We must have the audacity to say that the great projects of the living creation are not the products of chance and error. They point to a creating reason and show us a creating intelligence, and they do so more luminously and radiantly today than ever before." Let us pause to notice three of then-Cardinal Ratzinger's points. First, he says that life is not due to chance and error, a clear repudiation of the Darwinian claim. Second, there is physical evidence of design and purpose, the great projects of the living creation, which point to a creating reason. And third, Ratzinger cites the science of biochemistry, which studies the molecular foundation of life, as having particular relevance. It is biochemistry that has brought revolutionary insights. That is, biochemistry has uncovered new physical evidence pointing to design. And it is molecular biochemical systems that clearly presuppose a precisely thought through and therefore reasonable design. With this in mind, let's consider candidates for the mechanism of evolution, specifically for the evolution of the, quote, great projects of the living creation, close quote, the ones which, quote, point to a creating reason, close quote. Let's consider Darwinism. What is Darwinism? Well, recall that Cardinal Schoenborn defines Darwinism as an unguided unplanned process of random variation and natural selection. In other words, the very definition of Darwinism precludes a creating reason. If the great projects of the living creation were unplanned, if the process leading to them was unguided, then they cannot point to a creating reason, because in actual fact, nothing specifically intended them. In other words, Darwinian evolution of the great projects of life explicitly rules out planning or guidance by anyone, pointedly including God. No Christian who thinks consistently can accept that. Handsome fellow. Cardinal Schoenborn's definition of Darwinism has been challenged by some Christian thinkers, such as University of Delaware physics professor Stephen Barr, who we are privileged to have with us, when he was writing in the magazine First Things in the year 2005. The gist of Steve's most important objection is the following. Although some materialistic, ideology-driven scientists do indeed use words like unguided and unplanned, the hapless scientists are either careless or overstepping the bounds of science. The only scientifically defensible statement that can be made is that the process driving Darwinian evolution is random. Here, Barr means that the word random is used only in a scientifically technical sense, simply to mean uncorrelated. So the true scientific sense of random is just that: mutations are not matched to the needs of the organism. Mutations arise independently of the needs of the organism. Grand claims about guidance need not be considered. In other words, the great projects of the living creation may indeed have been planned, but we can't tell scientifically. So Professor Barr accuses Cardinal Schoenborn of illegitimately introducing the theologically charged words unguided and unplanned in his definition of Darwinism. But purely scientific Darwinian theory uses the neutral word random. I think that Steve's criticism of Cardinal Schoenborn is profoundly mistaken in two ways. First, the scientific community, as represented by its leading members and by its leading teaching organization, contradicts Professor Barr. They explicitly do mean that Darwinian evolution was unguided and unplanned. Second, the substitution of the word random, even in a technical sense of uncorrelated, simply does not change the bottom line. Even if evolution were just random in Barr's technical scientific sense, it cannot be said that the great projects of the living creation point to a creating reason. Let me amplify these points. I should have stood in front of the mirror and timed this. First, the scientific community does indeed mean that evolution was unguided and unplanned by anyone, including God. For example, in 1995, the National Association of Biology Teachers, the leading organization of teachers of biology in this country, issued the following statement, quote, "The diversity of life on Earth is the outcome of evolution, colon, an unsupervised, impersonal, unpredictable, and natural process of temporal descent with genetic modification. It is not at all difficult to figure out who they were intending to exclude with the words unsupervised and impersonal." Under public relations pressure, the NABT later revised its definition of evolution to leave out those words, with the understanding that the word natural implied them anyway. But the first statement clearly takes the temperature of the organization. By Darwinian evolution, the members of our largest science teachers association explicitly mean a process unguided and unplanned by anyone. Here's a second example. In September 2005, 2 months after Cardinal Schönborn's essay appeared in the New York Times, a group of 39 Nobel laureates sent an open letter to the Kansas State Board of Education, which was then embroiled in an evolution teaching controversy. The letter defined Darwinian evolution explicitly. Evolution is understood to be the result of an unguided, unplanned process of random variation and natural selection. Let me emphasize, this letter used the exact same terminology to define Darwinian evolution as Cardinal Schönborn used in his earlier essay. The letter defining Darwinian evolution as unguided and unplanned was signed by Richard Axel, Nobel laureate in medicine, 2004, Linda Bach, medicine, 2004, Günter Blobel, medicine, 1999, Aaron Chechenover, chemistry, 2004, Dudley Hirschbach, chemistry, 1986, Avram Hershko, chemistry, 2004, Roald Hoffman, chemistry, 1981, Robert Horvitz, medicine, 2002, and many others. Now, if the leading scientists who investigate biology and evolution, represented by Nobel Prize winners in science, explicitly say that by Darwinian evolution, they do mean a process that is unguided and unplanned, then that's what Darwinian evolution means. We are not free to use terms in our own way, to invent our own private definitions, ignoring how the terms are used by most people in the field. That only confuses the issue. Darwinian evolution means unguided and unplanned. I think it is clear, therefore, that no consistent Christian can accept Darwinian evolution. But is it possible that we could have a philosophically tame Darwinism? Perhaps call it by another name to avoid confusion with what scientists actually mean by the term. Tamed Darwinism could mean something like what Professor Barr had in mind, that mutations are technically random, uncorrelated with the needs of an organism, but that definition would carry no philosophical implications about being unplanned or unguided, as the Nobel laureates intended. We would leave those philosophical questions out of science. My response is a strong no. It is not possible. There is no such thing as tame Darwinism. Either the great projects of the living creation required planning or they did not. Random, in Barr's technical scientific sense, is no different from unplanned or unguided in the Nobel laureate sense. Let me explain. First, let us assume there is at least some true contingency in nature, including biology. For example, suppose some mutations do occur randomly, in the sense that not even God explicitly intended them to happen. They are simply the byproducts of various physical processes, perhaps foreseen by God, but unintended for themselves, even by God. Such mutations, of course, would occur in a manner uncorrelated with the needs of an organism. Now, scientists see mutations that appear to fit that description all the time. Neutral changes, genetic accidents, they all happen in a way in which, if we allow that there is at least some contingency in biology, appear unintended. The claim of scientists such as Nobel laureates that evolution is an unguided, unplanned process is simply the claim that such small, contingent, unintended mutations, which we have assumed do exist, are sufficient when coupled to the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection to account for the great projects of the living creation. Birds, fish, bacteria, the eye, molecular machines, everything. Nothing further is necessary. No planning or guidance. So Professor Barr's use of random in the sense of uncorrelated is a distinction without a difference. If the mutations that build the great projects of life are simply technically random or uncorrelated, then they are indeed unplanned and unguided too. And if random mutations can be put together to form the great projects of life, then those features of life needed no design. One objection that is often raised is that perhaps God designed the laws of the universe in the knowledge that they would lead to some sort of life. So in that sense, at least, we can say that God is the designer of life. But such a view falls radically short. Consider the kaleidoscope. The kaleidoscope is a toy containing small, brightly colored tumbling objects and a set of mirrors which reflect the view of the tumbling objects into repeating symmetric patterns. The inventor of the kaleidoscope can be credited with planning a machine which makes pretty patterns. But he can't be considered responsible for individual patterns that a kaleidoscope forms. So if, while playing around with a kaleidoscope, we observe a particular pattern which strikes us as really very attractive, we do not credit the inventor with that particular pattern. In truth, that particular kaleidoscope pattern was unguided and unplanned. In the same way, if the great projects of the living creation arise from simply the laws of nature, then, like a kaleidoscope pattern, we cannot say that they were guided or planned. But the view that God designed just the laws of the universe and the knowledge that they would lead to some sort of life or other with some sort of features has even worse problems. The great projects of the living creation, such as those discovered by biochemistry, about which Cardinal Ratzinger exclaimed, actually point more strongly to purposeful design than do the bare laws of nature. No matter how you slice it, in light of modern science, the eye or the bacterial flagellum, intracellular transport or a wing, exhibit a greater finality, a clearer purpose than do, say, the law of gravity or electromagnetism or natural selection, all of which are quite general. The purpose of the eye or the flagellum, however, are very specific. Both are quite precisely fitted to their jobs. Yet, if we are unable to discern design in systems which exhibit greater finality, then we cannot discern design in systems that exhibit less. If for any reason we cannot conclude that the eye was intended, then we cannot conclude that photons were intended either, or that the laws of electromagnetism were intended. The bottom line is that if the great projects of the living creation do not point to a creating reason, then nothing in nature does. If we cannot tell that they were planned, then we cannot tell that anything in nature was planned. Now, I know that over time, the term intelligent design has acquired a lot of baggage. So please put aside any preconceived notions you may have, and let me try to reintroduce the term afresh. What is intelligent design? Despite what newspapers may lead one to believe, It has nothing to do with creationism, intervention in nature, or other such negative connotations. Rather, it is simply the assertion that design is empirically detectable, that design can be deduced from physical evidence, that the actions of intelligent agents can leave marks in nature, and we can discern the actions of intelligent agents from those marks. Can we really tell from the physical empirical evidence that the great projects of the living creation were designed? Yes, we can. The future Pope Benedict XVI was exactly right when he wrote, "We must have the audacity to say that the great projects of the living creation are not the products of chance and error. They point to a creating reason and show us a creating intelligence, and they do so more luminously and radiantly today than ever before." In other words, if we agree with Benedict XVI, we must have the confidence to say that the physical evidence shows such things as the eye, wing, or molecular machinery were planned. The processes which produced them were guided. Physical evidence shows that they were specifically intended. We must insist that without specific planning and guidance, they would not have come about, even given the general laws of nature. In other words, they were purposely designed. Thank you for your attention.
First, I want to thank Dr. B for his relatively clear and very concise presentation, and also for this opportunity to respond to it. Let me get this mic in the right spot here. All right. I think we're good. And as he mentioned, there were two central points to his talk. The first was that certain biological structures appear to be intelligently designed because they exhibit what he calls irreducible complexity. The second was that Darwin's theory of evolution by random mutation and natural selection is incompatible with design. And further, he says that no consistent Christian can accept Darwinian evolution. Okay. While it'd be interesting to debate the concept of irreducible complexity, due to the limits of time, I'm going to focus on the second claim, partly because it's much more expansive, and it is one that I believe is much more important to address if one desires to get to the heart of the debate regarding Darwin's theory. Now, Dr. B made the very important point in his talk. He's saying discussion of evolution, Darwinism, and design becomes hopelessly confused if one is not exceedingly careful to define the terms and use them consistently. And I couldn't agree with him more on that point. But in addition to that, when one is evaluating the compatibility of Darwinism and Christianity, it is even more important to clearly distinguish between the scientific and philosophical meanings of the term Darwinism. Okay. In a nutshell, Darwin's scientific theory states the following, and this is what Dr. B. he had mentioned. The history of evolution on this planet can be explained primarily via natural selection working on random variations within organisms. And I would like to argue very briefly here in my time that as a scientific theory, there's nothing here that is inherently compatible with Christianity. Now, unfortunately, this scientific theory has been weighed down with so much philosophical baggage over the years that many people now believe that Darwin's scientific theory also demonstrates that there's no purpose or plan in nature. This is the version of Darwinism that Dr. Behe was referring to in his talk, and it was the one that many of the Nobel laureates were referring to. But I'd say this is wholly distinct from a Darwin's scientific theory. Right? This version that that there's no purpose and plan in nature, I agree with Dr. Behe, is entirely incompatible with Christianity, but it's also not a scientific theory. It is a philosophical worldview. Darwin's scientific theory cannot demonstrate that there is no purpose or plan to creation, nor can it demonstrate that humankind is a meaningless twig on the great tree of life. Those that claim otherwise are merely hijacking a scientific theory, thinking that life forms emerge via a process of random variations and natural selection, and tacking on questionable philosophical claims about the lack of purpose or design. Now, it doesn't matter how many Nobel laureates or science teachers or philosophers or biologists claim otherwise, a scientific theory cannot make statements regarding the absence of ultimate purposes and still claim to be a scientific theory. Those that make this claim or allow others to do are merely allowing bad philosophy to masquerade as science, a situation, in my opinion, that only serves to confuse matters. It is far better to expose the bad philosophy for what it is so that one can evaluate Darwin's scientific theory on its own legs. So how is it that so many people have erroneously equated Darwin's scientific theory with a world devoid of purpose? Nobel laureates and so on. Well, it all stems from erroneously equating a process involving random variation with a process that is unplanned and unsupervised. In the case of Darwin's theory, this argument goes something like this: because the variations that are involved in transforming one population of organisms into another are random and their exact occurrence is unpredictable, then the whole process must be unplanned, unsupervised, and devoid of design. This line of argument is enough for some people to dump Darwin's theory wholesale for its lack of compatibility with Christianity, or for others to embrace it wholesale for its atheistic undertones. If we accept this line of reasoning, though, I think we get into a predicament, because we have to then conclude that the randomness and unpredictability of many other events in life are devoid of design. Meiosis, the process of fertilization, the chance encounter of meeting one's future wife at an airport after they have a flat tire and miss their plane, they're all things that would then be devoid of design. That's not how I met my wife, by the way. It's much more devoid of design than that. But the fact of the matter is, we don't jump from random and unpredictable to unplanned and devoid of design in these cases. At least I hope we don't. The reason we do not is because the mere occurrence of random contingent events does not preclude God's providence. Events that are contingent in our eyes, ones that we cannot predict, or ones that appear uncorrelated to us, can still be used by God to obtain his ends. As Aquinas has said, the effect of divine providence is not only that things should happen somehow, but they should happen either by necessity or by contingency. And skipping a bit, and that happens from contingency, which the divine providence conceives to happen from contingency. Things that are random do not occur outside of God's providence. The point here is that nothing in Darwin's scientific theory is incompatible with Christianity, because randomness and contingency can be entirely compatible with a loving, all-powerful creator who allows these events to occur to fulfill his own ends. Now, despite this, there's a second point I would like to make that builds off of this. Because of all the randomness and unpredictability they see in evolution, atheistic Darwinists continue to fall all over themselves to point out how contingent and chance events run evolution, as if that somehow magically removes God from the picture. I mean, all the time you hear, well, if the asteroid didn't hit Earth 60 million years ago, humans wouldn't be here today. Right? Putting aside the scientific problems with that argument, one of the biggest ironies, I think, of the situation is that these atheists, preoccupied as they are with the random aspects of Darwin's theory, fail to acknowledge the elephant in the room, which is that there is an immense amount of order that is required for his theory to even get off the ground. Natural selection cannot work without the universe that we occupy, and that requires a huge amount of order. I mean, natural selection is not a thing. You can't point to it, oh, here's natural selection, look at it. It's a process that works on something, and it works on nature. Right? So it is this order that I think in the universe that helps direct and, more importantly, point to a creator. So contrary to what we might think in some of our weaker moments, we do not live in a chaotic universe. Turning to Cardinal Schoenberg again, as Dr. Behe had in his talk a couple times, I'll take a quote from one of his lectures. He said, "The entire scientific enterprise is the discovery of the order, laws, connections, and relationships. It is the discovery of the letters, the grammar, the syntax, and ultimately the text itself that God has put into the book of creation." Now, this text that has been written into the book of creation is not simple to decode, but what has been deciphered at this point is breathtaking in scope and elegance. Studies have revealed a universe that seems beautifully balanced to sustain life, a universe that is deeply relational in ways that are still puzzling to the best scientific minds, a universe that is remarkably intelligible and ordered, and for the purposes of my talk, a universe that I believe is remarkably suited for natural selection. Now, what do I mean by that last point? For natural selection to work, it absolutely requires the existence of specific, stabled, ordered entities, namely organisms or some type of molecule, to sift through. The natural selection has to have something to work on. Right? A universe, for example, that consists solely of chaotic clouds of gas that flee in and out of existence would render natural selection impotent. A universe with nothing more complex than hydrogen atoms would also leave natural selection unemployed. Yet we find ourselves in a universe which stable ordered entities like amoebas, frogs, squirrels, etc. exist. And the question, why is this? Now, on a scientific level, one can point to the existence of the stable ordered entities like frogs is largely due to the fact that they're made of stable ordered proteins, which in turn owe their existence to the stable ordered amino acids of which they are composed. Now, these amino acids owe their stability and order to the limited number of stable order elements that exist in our universe. There's a limited possibility there. Right? And it has to do with these elements, the limited ones that exist, and their stability has to do with the existence of the stable order at the subatomic level, forces and the subatomic particles. The key point that I'm trying to make is that order at each level is utterly dependent upon order at a level below it. And natural selection is absolutely dependent upon all of these levels. It is absolutely dependent upon this order being written into our universe. As Stephen Barr mentioned in his book, a quote from his book, Modern Physics and Ancient Faith, he states, "The order which we see in nature at one level has its roots in a more mathematically perfect order that exists at a deeper level." Given this order, the existence of this order, which is a gift to natural selection in a sense, natural selection can, coupled with random variations, can mine through it and unveil the potentialities that are inherent in it. One example of to illustrate this concept can be seen in the structure of proteins, which are the major building block of cells and organisms, one of the major building blocks. Now, despite the infinite number of proteins are made of amino acids, little building blocks, but despite the infinite sort of arrangement or sequence of amino acids that you have, you could string together them in many, many different orders. Nearly infinite array of orders, they all will collapse or fold into two stable ordered secondary structures, alpha helices and beta sheets. In addition, combinations of those then fold into about 500 or so basic protein forms or folds, forms that are based upon the order that is inherent in the amino acids themselves. So why do proteins fold into alpha helices and beta sheets? Why don't they form into other things? It's largely because of the structure of the amino acids, the backbone of them that they all share, that is based upon the chemistry, which is based upon the physics that undercovers them, underlies them. Now, this should be a breathtaking realization. It was to me when I came across this in graduate school. Despite an infinite number of possible combinations of amino acids, only a very limited number of possible protein forms appear to be stable in our universe. In fact, totally divergent sequences, so you have proteins that are made of totally different amino acids, will fold into very similar structures. These forms are not being imposed upon the proteins, but they are actually part of the very nature and action of proteins, which have the ordered chemical and physical laws built into their very being. Natural selection does not have to construct these forms from scratch. It merely uncovers what is already there. Right? Conway Morris, in his book, Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe, captures this notion on a much grander scale. His argument is largely based off the fact that certain structures or behaviors appear repeatedly throughout evolution in distinctly different branches of life. Examples include camera-like eyes, echolocation, viviparity. And there's many, many others. It's an excellent book. I'd recommend it to anybody. Morris argues that given the ordered structure and the constraints that exist in our universe, these specific structures or behaviors are so robust that natural selection, coupled with random variations, will find them repeatedly. The exact pathway may be unpredictable to us, but just like a rock, when it bounces down a hill, takes an unpredictable pathway, it will reach the bottom. The end result is not necessarily random. So in conclusion, when we look at evolutionary history, it is certainly clear that it is influenced by chance encounters and random events. It does not follow, though, from this that there is no purpose or plan to creation. We cannot reject Darwin's scientific theory as incompatible with Christianity merely because it incorporates chance events. Such chance events can be part of God's providential plan, just as the chance encounters of our everyday life can be fraught with transcendent purpose and meaning. In addition to the randomness, now, an examination of evolutionary history also reveals, and this is, I think, even more important, it reveals an underlying order that appears to funnel natural selection towards certain forms. This is what the science reveals. And if we step back from this and read it more broadly, then we can see that the scope, that more broadly than the scope of science, and I use that in the term of the modern empirical sciences, allows, we can see or that it paints a picture consistent with the God who has endowed the universe with the order and creative capacity to carry out his plan. Thank you.